Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past 4 following news, we'll hear about Consumers Energy's 7 oldest coal plants shutting down by April 15th.
It's a real transformative time, and one way to think about it is once these go away and we make our plans to go forward, we're going to be reducing our carbon footprint, our company's carbon footprint, by about 25%. And we really should make very clear that as of April 15th, April 16th, when you flip the switch, the power will still be on. Yeah, exactly.
Kirk Heinze talks with the leader of MSU's Center for Regional Food Systems, and President Simon and A.D. Hollis talk with Dan Gould, who leads MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports. MSU Today begins at 4:06. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, Consumers Energy will be shutting down the Classic 7. The Classic 7 is the nickname of 7 of its oldest coal-fired plants, and they'll do this by April 15th. Here to tell us about it and to discuss implications for Michigan's energy future is good friend Brian Wheeler. Brian is the Senior Public Information Director for Consumers. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
First, the Classic 7 and shutting down by April 15th, coming right up here. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's a real historic time. These are 7 coal plants. We have 12 in total, 7 coal generating units. And our plan all along has been to have them go what we call cold and dark by April 15th. And so that's happening. These are plants that are in the Muskegon area, that are in the Bay County area, and then also in Monroe County. And we've been talking about it for a long time. It's finally here.
Well, those 7 plants, as I understand it, some information you provided, represent about 1/3 of your total fleet of plants, right? I mean, that's a lot of capacity.
Right, exactly. We, in fact, are a bit of a leader when it comes to this issue. Only one other utility in the country is shutting down a larger percentage of their coal-fired generation. And these are really interesting facilities. If you go to places like Muskegon, for example, the Cobb plant that's there, these plants have been around since the 40s and 50s, since the Truman administration. So, you know, there's great history there. People who grew up in Muskegon, for example, know and in many cases love the Cobb plant.
Yeah, they're almost iconic. I've been to Muskegon and I've seen that plant, for example, and it's an icon, but people are talking about it closing down. And of course, one of the things that always comes up in conversations like that, I mean, what is this going to do for energy efficiency and for carbon footprint?
Yeah, it's a real transformative time, and one way to think about it is once these go away and we make our plans to go forward, we're going to be reducing our carbon footprint, our company's carbon footprint, by about 25%. So that's a significant change.
It's huge.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And there's no doubt they are indeed closing by April 15th. There's no going back on that. And then going forward, we have 5 more coal plants to stay open. We've spent about $2 billion, billion with a B, to really improve their efficiency, to reduce their emissions, so that we are continuing to be as clean and sustainable as we can going forward.
When you're shutting down about 1/3 of your fleet or your capacity, I mean, how are you making up that energy generation?
Right, yeah, and we really should make very clear that as of April 15th, April 16th, when you flip the switch, the power will still be on. Yeah, exactly. In our case, what we've done, we purchased a gas plant in our backyard in Jackson. That's where our headquarters are. This was a privately owned plant, and it was put up for sale. We purchased it for a very affordable price, and that is making up most of the difference. We have some short-term purchase agreements to help fill in the gap otherwise. But then you're right, going forward, Michigan's going to continue to grow. There's going to continue to be a need for new electricity, new energy, and we're going to have to do more.
My guest is Brian Wheeler. He's the Senior Public Information Director for Consumers Energy. Brian, what implications does this have? There's been a lot of talk about the state of Michigan developing an energy plan going forward. You folks have been involved. Michigan State University, the University of Michigan, are both involved in long-term energy plans, a lot of them moving away from coal. But closing these plants, I mean, is that just part of the evolution? And where is this evolution taking us?
Right. One kind of personal note I'll share if you have a moment here is that I was recently in Florida on vacation. That's what a lot of us Michiganders do this time of year. And I was in Fort Myers and went to the Edison Ford Winter Estates.
Been there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thomas Edison spent his winters there. He enjoyed the warm weather, too. And, you know, I was looking at some of the artifacts, some of the inventions he had done. You know, it was really in the 1880s that it was a revolution in terms of developing electric power generation. 1881, he developed the first meter. 1882, he helped develop the first power plant in New York City. And our company actually came into existence in 1886. So a real amazing time. This is probably analogous to that in terms of what we're seeing. The world is changing. Coal as the real backbone of energy delivery for our state, for our nation, is diminished. We're moving toward natural gas. We're moving toward renewables, and we're moving toward energy efficiency, which I know you've alluded
right.
to. You know, we've helped our customers, homes and businesses that we've served, to save over $1 billion in their energy costs just since 2009. That's a real significant difference, and I don't think decades ago, a generation ago, anybody would have foreseen this.
A lot. You mentioned natural gas. You mentioned renewables. You mentioned energy efficiency. A really strong kind of three-legged stool there. Is natural gas a transition energy source? Renewables really where it's going to be at 20, 30, 40 years from now? Or are we going to continue to have a mix?
I think you're on the right path there. There probably always will be and probably should be a balance, because you never want to bet the house on any one particular technology or one approach. But natural gas has been a game changer, because the exploration of natural gas in this country has really grown a lot in recent years. The price has come down significantly. Natural gas traditionally hasn't been as affordable as coal. That's why coal
right.
has been the go-to.
Right.
And natural gas is right there. So certainly it's at least a bridge, maybe even more than that. And then, of course, we are doing much more in the way of renewables in terms of wind and solar, and who knows whatever else comes around next. But, you know, we alluded to the energy law, the discussion that's going on there in Lansing. We have a law that was created in 2008. There's work to get another one on the books. And the significance of that is that it's really, like any good law, it's a blueprint, it's an aspiration. For us, before we make those major investments to, say, build another power plant, which will probably be necessary at some point, we need to have good ground rules in effect.
Now, I know, again, you've been working very closely with the governor's people, with Valerie Brader's office, the Office of Energy. We were expecting to see something by now. Where is that energy plan development, and when can we expect to see something?
Yeah, there was a lot of work that was going on last year. It's a really complex issue, obviously. We're kind of doing, we're having a lot, covering a lot of ground here, but there are a lot of details to go through. Mm-hmm. So work is continuing right now. Senator Mike Knopf chairs the Senate Energy and Policy Committee, and he was one of the architects of the 2008 law. It's great to have that institutional knowledge that he brings to this conversation. So right now he's working on trying to draft some legislation from what we understand. Our hope would be that a bill moves through the Senate, moves through the House this year, and gets to the governor's desk, and so we can have something on the books before 2016 is over.
Let's come back to renewables for a moment. I'd be remiss. We talked to Patty Poppe about this. You're soon to be CEO,
mm-hmm.
I think, coming up in July. Your solar gardens program.
Right. We talk about April being a big month because we have the 7 coal plants going away. Actually, by the end of the month, one of our first solar gardens site, a new community solar program site in at Grand Valley State University, is going to be operating. So our first solar garden site, these are large-scale solar projects. Oftentimes we think about solar panels being on your rooftop, for example, or perhaps located at a home or a business. This is acres and acres of property, hundreds of panels of solar panels that'll be installed and generating electricity for us. We're also working on developing a site at Western Michigan, Western Michigan University, I should say, which will be operational by the fall, and then we'll be looking to do more.
Yeah, we're now all of a sudden in the last year or so hearing more and more about solar projects, where previously most of the emphasis has been on wind, but solar is emerging.
It is, and we talked about safe energy efficiency a decade or a generation ago. You wouldn't have been able to predict necessarily where we are today. We'll see where we are in a decade or a generation on solar. The issue with solar, the thing that's been the hang-up, has really been the cost, because you can build solar projects for a reasonable enough price, but when you think about sort of your return on investment, you are reliant on the sun shining, mm-hmm. and you need technology that really maximizes that. So the cost for every unit of electricity, for every watt of electricity you generate, hasn't been as competitive as coal or natural gas. Obviously, the technology is changing. We're watching and working with people in the industry to see where this goes, because we want to be responsive to the fact that many people are interested in being clean and sustainable when it comes to the energy generation.
Well, I really liked your analogy of Edison and Ford and Firestone got together down in Fort Myer. Imagine the genius in that room. And now we're in a transition phase. A lot of people working on a lot of new technologies, working on conservation, working on new plants. I mean, it's an exciting time in Michigan's energy future and also in the nation's energy future.
Yeah, the model that was established in the late 1800s by folks like Edison has been largely intact for that time and since that time. And now the game is changing, and we're changing right there with it. So it's exciting. You know, anytime there's a big change, there's disruption, there's questions about how things are going to happen going forward. I think at a minimum, at least for today, what we want to continue to tell people is that when you need the energy for your home or business, we've got you. We've got it provided to you. We're working to keep it affordable and keep any increases in the price below inflation. And so you need to know that you have what you need today.
Well, Brian, as the energy policy unfolds, I mean, we always enjoy talking to you and to folks from consumers, but thanks so much for being on the program and giving us an update on the Classic 7.
Yeah, we could talk for hours about this, but thanks for your time and interest in the subject.
My guest has been Brian Wheeler, Senior Public Information Director for Consumers Energy. Brian, always good to see you.
Thank you.
Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, we've heard a lot over the past several years about urban and rural food deserts and the problems associated with good sustainable food systems for some of America's poorest communities. But the MSU Center for Regional Food Systems has been working to ameliorate these problems and much more. Here to tell us about this important work is Richard Pierog, the director of the MSU Center for Regional Food Systems. He's also appointed in the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State. Rich, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Give us a snapshot of the work of the Center for Regional Food Systems at Michigan State.
Sure. We have this vision for Michigan of a thriving economy, equity, and sustainability for everyone. And we do that through local and regional food. And we talk about something called good food. And when we say good food, we mean food that is healthy, that's affordable, that is fair. Nobody across the food system was exploited in its production or its preparation, and that it's green. And by green, we just mean that it's environmentally sound. It was produced in an environmentally sound manner. So that vision that we have, although we do a lot of our work here in Michigan, also extends to some of our national and international work about how we can make food systems that are more regional in scope more sustainable.
You know, we've done some programs here about folks who are doing a lot of work in the urban communities, but in some of our email correspondence ahead of this interview, you reminded me that there are rural communities that have issues related to good, sustainable food systems.
In this country, and certainly in Michigan, we have areas where, both in rural Michigan and urban Michigan, where you can go into a corner store or a convenience store, and you'll probably be able to find plenty of snack foods, but you won't be able to find a variety of produce items, a variety of milk, meat, eggs, like you would in a full-line supermarket. And this is an issue here from the standpoint of food access in a state like Michigan. And one of the parts of what we call the Michigan Good Food Charter, and that term good food, again, means the same thing, healthy, fair, green, and affordable, is that everybody in Michigan should have access
to healthy foods. And it's a little harder. We've lost grocery stores in places like Flint. We've lost grocery stores in rural Michigan. And so part of the work that we're involved in here through the Good Food Charter and also through an exciting new fund called the Michigan Good Food Fund is to help provide opportunities for loans and business assistance so we can get more of those healthy food items in both rural and urban locations in Michigan.
We have, and you know this, we have food banks all over the state of Michigan. We have urban gardening going on in cities like Flint and Detroit. We have churches involved in supplying nutritious food. What's the role in coordinating all of these so that people are sort of marching to the same drummer?
All of the organizations and groups that you mentioned play a really important role. The food banks, churches, community gardens, more and more across the state, local food banks.
Farmers markets.
Farmers markets have stepped up to the plate and have addressed food access issues. We have programs in this state, wonderful programs like Double Up Food Bucks, where you can go if you are eligible for SNAP benefits. You can go to a farmer's market. You have these Double Up Food Bucks, and you can get more produce for your dollar than you would. So we're trying to put that incentive on you know, being able to get those items so that they're very easily affordable and that they're accessible. So the part of I think it's both an opportunity and sometimes it's a challenge is there's many of these different programs and just agreeing on a set of overarching goals for the state. And I think, and this is one of the things that the Good Food Charter has been very, very successful in. We have well more than 100 organizations that actively participate in the Good Food Charter, including food banks and nonprofit organizations, faith-based organizations, our state agencies, and they all agree that the goals of increasing healthy food access are laudable, important goals for the state. And we try to encourage and incentivize each other as we look at grant funding, as we look at opportunities to use what we have in our own institutional resources that we have within agencies and organizations to find those areas where we need the most help in underserved parts of the state and put extra efforts in those particular areas where, you know, for example, we have farmers markets in all parts of the state, but in places like rural Northeast Michigan, they're far and few in between. And so, you know, we need to be able to communicate with each other and look at where those areas are and see if we can put more resources into those areas.
My guest is Richard Pirog. He is the director of the MSU Center for Regional Food Systems. Rich, if somebody's listening to this interview in Flint or in Northeast Michigan, as you mentioned, you're a family, you're concerned about the nutrition of your kids, you're not quite sure where to go first. I mean, what are the first couple steps that a family could take?
Probably one of the best first steps, and again, being part of MSU and also having an extension appointment, there's a set of programs around nutrition, health, food access, around local food that one can access by just contacting your county extension office. And they can put you in touch with some of the more specialized programs that may fit your particular needs. They also may refer you to other local agencies and organizations that are working in both the healthy food access or local food or, you know, specifically about, say, where are my farmers markets? Where can I shop? Are there other opportunities? There's things like community-supported agriculture, where as a consumer you can get a subscription and farmers either deliver or you pick up produce and other Michigan items weekly during a season. So there's a lot of opportunities. And through that extension office, the consumer can get connected to a number of the programs that we offer
right.
at the Center for Regional Food Systems.
And for our listeners who may not know, there's an MSU extension presence in every county
in the
state.
Every county in the state. And if you have the internet, you just have to Google your county name and extension, and you'll find that address. If you don't, you could still use the old Yellow Pages or phone book, and you'll be able to find them.
Rich, there have been some real interesting and, I think, positive developments in Detroit lately. I think Meijer has established a second store in Detroit. Whole Foods has been involved in some of the urban communities. How important is this private sector collaboration when we're talking about food security and healthful food systems?
It's absolutely critical that we have public-private partnerships as we try to build the food security. And by food security, again, I mean everybody in Michigan has access to healthy food. You know, estimates when we started the Good Food Charter 5 or 6 years ago were in around 65% of Michigan residents had, and that was an optimistic number, had healthy food access. The number, you know, we have as a goal is at least 80%. We'd love to see 100% of our residents having healthy food access. And I mentioned earlier a program which is an example of a public-private partnership called the Michigan Good Food Fund. It's a $30 million fund that will provide loans and business assistance to businesses not only in food retail, but on the production side, on the processing or distribution side of food, particularly if those businesses are working to serve and supply food in underserved rural and urban parts of the state. And so we're looking right now at loans and business assistance in places like Detroit, places like Flint. And it's not only the healthy food access, but the loans and the business assistance help create jobs.
Yeah,
it recirculates more dollars in the economy as you create those jobs. Those people spend their money in the communities. And so we look at this as both an economic development, a health and community development issue, and an equity issue, because in urban and rural areas of this state and many states, some of our areas of highest poverty, some of our areas that have lowest income, also, not in all cases, but in many cases, are also areas where we have high populations of people of color. So we really want this to be a program that uses a lens of equity so we can grow more businesses with leaders of people of color in urban parts. And we have other parts of the state in rural areas where we have a number of Native American communities. The same applies there as well.
Rich, I know you're doing a presentation shortly coming up on racism in the food system. Unfortunately, we're out of time on this interview, but would love to have you back to talk more in depth about racism in the food system. But congratulations on the many initiatives at the MSU Center for Regional Food Systems. My guest has been Richard Pirog. He is the director of the MSU Center for Regional Food Systems. And Rich, pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
WKAR.
MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis now welcome Dan Gould to the program. Dan leads MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports. Here's President Simon.
One of the things that is extraordinarily important as you think about the evolution of a college of education and the work that we've done is the extraordinary science that's been a part of thinking about sport. And the college, the Department of Kinesiology, does a lot of things that is not the old PE. It's sort of it's not your what you would imagine in that department. It's extraordinarily science-based. And John Gold has been a part of that work for a very long time. And one of the emphasis we've had is worrying about youth in sport from a physiological perspective, a psychological perspective, and also the nature and culture of sport. So it's really a pleasure for me to introduce somebody I've known for a very long time and someone who really is the head of our Institute for the Study of Youth Sports. So, Dan, thank you for being here. And tell people what occupies your time these days as you think about the issues of youth and sport.
Yeah, well, the Institute's been around for almost 30 years now, and we're started by the legislature of the state of Michigan because they had concern about children in sport. And our purpose is pretty simple, to scientifically study the benefits and detriments of sport for children and youth, and as you alluded to, physical, psychological, yeah, social, and then to partner with organizations to help enrich communities in Michigan and nationwide, to really help families do a better job so kids get benefits from sport. So some of the things that we're working on, we're doing a lot of work right now on sport parents and how to help them be optimally involved. Like Jim Pavarnik of our department studies pregnancy and exercise. And if moms are more, when they're pregnant, active, they tend to have kids that have some physical benefits. So we know we need parent involvement and physical activity at a very young age. But then the more we talk to high school coaches, you hear about the over-involved parent and, you know, kind of the crazy sport parent. And yet our research shows 7 out of 10 parents are pretty darn good. And there's, you know, 1 or 2 that get overexcited. So how do we help educate that parent and the coaches so it's better for the kids?
Well, Dan, this radio show is not going to be enough time for all the questions that I have for you. I think we need a mini series to get much of it out. But it's interesting that as you look at our media today, the attention and the focus that's being placed on a topic that you do a great amount of research in, the entitlement word that's used so much of young kids coming up, whether it be in sports or just in general. Much of the conversation's been about a child's lifestyle getting impacted early on based upon sport and evolving through college and then into the workplace. And it's the trophy for everyone mentality. It's the intensity that perhaps a college coach will deliver to a student athlete for the first time when they've always received nothing but praise and that whole process. And I don't even know how to dabble into this because it's a very broad concept, but it's something that is concerning to those of us in intercollegiate athletics, because what we're seeing from a coaching perspective, we were just talking about it earlier, is coaches have had an opportunity to evolve with changing students as they come in, and now it's changing so fast that the pace and the ability to keep up has been quite a challenge for coaches in all sports, frankly.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's a lot of challenges today. And on one hand, we know at the youngest ages, kids need very positive experiences in sport. They need to feel good about themselves, feel successful, feel competent. And at the same time, they also need to learn life lessons like responsibility,
And losing
and winning, yeah. And when does that come in the formula? And there's a lot of interesting research right now on athletic talent development, and kids go through phases like fun and fundamentals.
Right.
So you don't want too early of sport specialization. You want to try multiple sports, do things like that. Then they learn how to train, and then they train to train, and then like here at Michigan State, they're training to perform and win.
Right.
And it's a developmental progress, and some of our research now looks at responsibility and how kids are, how you can as a coach kind of have a positive environment, mm-hmm. but it's not always fun. Yeah. In fact, we have a study of an intensive wrestling camp now that we're dubbing, it's just underway, Navy SEAL training meets positive youth development, because the coach is very interesting that he physically, with the kid's choice and parents, pushes kids, but then talks a lot about lessons in life, and they have reflective journals at night. So it's a real interesting combination of how you can use physical activity to learn some life values, but some of those lessons are tough. And it's really important for kids to learn how to lose as well as win. And I think over the years, we've been so concerned with the self-esteem, which is important, that we forgot. It's not just about being positive. It's important to be contingent. Yep. So you have to earn it.
When I grew up, in Lexington, Michigan, which is up in the Thumb. And I was at Meyer Elementary School. And there was the dreaded rope. And as a young child, I mean, it still sits with me today. There's three categories. There's the people that didn't try. There's the people that tried and failed. And there's the people that made it to the top. And I think, you know, I was in that first category for a long time. I was scared to death to try because you'd see and, you know, I can't do that. I was probably as proud of the time I tried and didn't make it to the top as the time I made it to the top. And it's the ropes are non-existent in elementary schools today. And part of that's probably because of safety. and part of it is probably because parents have said, I don't want my child put in that condition of being bullied from being in the category of not trying. But as you go through and you watch baseball, softball, soccer, at what age is it okay to learn how to lose? At what age is it okay to make that transition from T-ball where everybody runs around the bases to actually there's a winner and a loser? And it should hurt a little bit to lose. And it should feel good to win. And when you lose, there's life lessons that you're going to carry with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, great question. I don't think we have an exact answer, but I would say there's a lot of research that shows around 11 or 12, kids developmentally and cognitively change so they can understand winning and losing more like an adult. They can differentiate between effort and ability. So to me, your entry programs, you know, below 10, 11, 11 or 12, you don't throw them off the deep end into a cutthroat competitive environment, but then maybe in competition becomes more a part of it. You win sometimes, you lose sometimes. And I think a lot of it's the environment the coach creates. Because we've studied coaches. We have a partner in Detroit, Think Detroit Police Athletic League, that does a great job down there. But we studied some of their coaches who are more versus less effective. And overall, they do a great job. And I applaud them because they weren't afraid to study internally. But their less effective coaches felt you had to toughen kids up in Detroit and yell at them and be on them all the time. And the youth development literature shows that isn't necessarily the best strategy. At the same time, just always being positive. And it's sort of this collaborative approach where you hold kids to standards. They know the expectations. If they fail, you might feel bad because they fail, but they have to sort of live with the consequences. And at the same time, you're trying to catch them doing things right. So coaching sort of this delicate art, just like it is in business or other things. When I hear President Simon talk about support and challenge, how do I support the faculty and how do we challenge us to go places we've never been because we're in such a competitive world environment today? And it's this delicate balance that we're trying to find as coaches or leaders. And a lot of what we're doing is trying to help parents, coaches, and leaders figure that out. There's a researcher that talks a lot about, as a parent, when do you intervene to protect your child and when do you let your child fail? And the hardest thing for a lot of parents today is to let their child fail because that could be, as John Wooden would say, mistakes are the building blocks of success, and it's okay to make a mistake, even though your instinct as a parent is to jump in and protect your child. And I think a lot of parents have that balance wrong today for good intentions, but we're trying to help provide information. Some of our studies have pointed to something called optimal parent push. As a parent, you stress values, hard work, you make a commitment to the team. Yeah, you went to the sleepover Saturday night, but yeah, you still have to go to practice the next day or whatever it is. And at the same time, the parents aren't totally tied to outcome and winning. Winning's important. In fact, we've done studies of Olympic champions. They follow this pattern. The parents emphasize values. Do it, you do it right, follow through. But they don't get too hung up on if you're winning or losing. Or we see a lot of parents now crazy about getting their kid a scholarship. And I always say,
a full scholarship.
Yeah. And I say, go to the library. Yeah. Your chances are about 150. We want them in sports. Yeah. But, you know, so it's just sort of like focus on the process, teaching these life lessons, and you're going to have better results in the long run.
Well, I think that's the real value of your research is connecting the sport to life after college, and it's that whole transition process is what's interesting. ESPN just had a fabulous series on youth sports and the evolution into college, and Bob Knight was actually part of that conversation, but it was dealing with confrontation for the first time, and it went into, you know, the term that's heavily used is the helicopter parent, and talked about the communication that takes place between today's college students and their parents is in the range of 5 to 6 times daily, where, you know, it was maybe 5 to 6 times a semester when I was going through school. And it's not only the parents, it's other individuals that are part of their lives that are feeding information, and what that information does to the psyche that concerns you, or you know, much of it is well-intended. Some of it is well-intended for the individual that's providing the feedback. But that feedback has evolved into things like Twitter and social media and blogs and newspaper articles, especially when you get into some of the more elite athletes in soccer or baseball or football and the like. And it creates almost a sense of greatness that supersedes the reality of their work ethic that they've put into that point. I don't even know if I'm asking a question right now.
But I think it's the whole entitlement. If you're talented when you're young and everybody tells you you're great, so then you do something at school that would normally mean you don't play that night, but we need to win the game, so I let you play.
Right.
And then everybody's treating you special, and now you get to Michigan State, and, you know, it's sort of like, I think I own the place, and, well, why do I need to follow through? And then you play for some of our top coaches like Coach Izzo and D'Antonio that sort of have rules. Imagine it's a rude reality waking for some young people.
It also translates, I think, academically, because many students who come to Michigan State have been very actively involved in some aspect of sport prior to coming. They've soccer leagues, because soccer leagues are something that most communities do. It helps leadership, so they write down they were on the varsity team and they did all of these kinds of things. And they just, you know, expect that once they finish high school, they're not going to play at any level that is a Division I. So they're going to come to a high level D1 school to get an education, and they come with a little bit of that entitlement philosophy too, as it relates to, gee whiz, not going to the math tutoring we're offering right now in the residence halls, or gee whiz, you know, I'm really good, so somebody should be doing something for me instead of me being responsible for, you know, asking the professor a question. And there's a little bit of bleed over, as we've gotten so many, I think appropriately, so many kids in organized sport throughout their K-12 experience.
But in education, as a parent, those are things you wrestle with in the academic side.
Right.
Is when do you stop calling the teacher and push your child to say, you go ask the teacher why you got this grade, or you go ask the teacher what you're missing.
Right.
And it's coaching the child.
And so it's the same. I think some of the issues that are part of the research of youth sport also occur as I think about the way in which students engage with us, because we do have high expectations. The expectations here for performance are higher than some other places they could go. That's what they're paying for.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR, and you're in the middle of a conversation between Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, and MSU Institute for the Study of Youth Sports leader Dan Gould.
These are great points, and I think sport in many ways is a microcosm of society. So 30 years ago, we didn't have parent orientation when we brought campuses. Now we have helicopter parents here that are concerned about their kids.
I was in the pit all by myself when I registered.
that dates us.
And you stayed in the pit the next year to see who the freshmen were that you might want to befriend.
But I think this whole teaching responsibility is really important. And I think a mission of Michigan State is for us to study things like social media, parenting, and then disseminate that information to the public, because as a parent, you're scared today. It's the first generation where the Gallup polls tell us you don't expect your kids to be as successful as you are. You're worried about the competitive world. So you're really trying to protect your kid. And parents are doing the things for the right reason. But I think they make some fundamental flaws sometime without knowing it. And I haven't been a parent myself and raised kids. There's this urge to protect them. And the worst thing to do is sit at a basketball game and just keep my mouth shut and let them play. And then when do you say a couple things? And I'm trained and felt that pressure to intervene. So I think if we can make parents, we've had really good luck with parent education. We're also doing things with kids. We work with the Michigan High School Athletic Association for a number of years now doing captains leadership training. Because there's this notion that captains learn how to lead. Most of our research shows that coaches do very little to teach captains how to lead. So Michigan is very innovative, the high school association, and we do programs to train kids how to lead. And a really good example would be, how do you confront? How do I tell my best friend when I'm a junior in high school that she's not working hard enough? And with a peer pressure, that's hard for adults to do. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there that we can do to really help kids and parents. And again, I think their motives are good. It's just that we need to get good information out to them, tips for helping kids learn responsibility, for not being, you know, not developing entitlement, lack of a better word. And some of it is, I'll say tough love, but it's hard as a parent to watch that your kid look disappointed when you're disciplining them. And I think we need to get back to some of that, find this right balance.
Let me shift gears, because even the President of the United States has got into the act about sports injuries, focusing on football in particular. You have, at that one level, you have the high-profile NFL issues at another. So how what are you seeing in terms of this issue of management of injuries? Because you've looked at this for a very long time. So what's changed? What's better today? What's worse?
It's a great question. We have a great researcher in our department, Tracy Kovacin, who studies concussions and learning a lot about concussions. And, you know, the good news is we're finding things out. And then a lot of it, like I know Coach D'Antonio, they were working together on a proper tackling and football video. So I think we can do some things about injuries. But historically, if we look at injuries in youth sports, prior to puberty, the injury rates are fairly low. After puberty is when you get one kid at Little League World Series that has a mustache at 12 and another kid that's about 4 foot tall, and they're together, you get more injuries there. There is some inherent risk in sport, any sport. Knee injuries in girls in basketball is a higher incident than boys. There's a variety of reasons for that. Doesn't mean they shouldn't play. But it probably means we need better qualified coaches, more work on preventative medicine, so we don't give girls the same weight program that we've given boys, because anatomically they're different, hormones are different, et cetera. So I think a lot of it, again, is good at coach education. And in America, we don't do a very good job with that. You need a hat and whistle to coach youth sports. And the more we can inform coaches, the more we can prevent some of these injuries. But it's a fact of life. I think we're getting a lot of press on it right now. But education, to me, is the answer in that.
Let me sort of ask the difficult question about what I would call, what if you're in the NCAA venue or the NFL, you're going to call performance-enhancing drugs that have been banned. If you're out in the world that I see at gyms and health food stores and everything that is sort of how do I make myself healthier, some of which includes substances that might be on these lists later on, but they're not necessarily illegal. They're not banned by high schools. They're not banned by midget hockey teams. They're all just okay. But they do produce effects for youth that then carry over either when they have to be continued now illegally, or they put a kid at risk for having done this for a while and then stopping. because now they're being monitored by some nefarious organization.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. First, if you look at the whole supplement industry, it's unregulated. And I know my work with the Olympic Committee over the years is you tell your top athletes you don't take anything without a person who's U.S. Anti-Doping Agency approved kind of saying it's okay to take, because you buy it off the shelf at the store. You don't know what you're getting. So that's, I think, part of it. We need, from just a protection to stay out of trouble as an athlete, don't put stuff in your body unless you're exactly sure what it is. Then with the internet and everything, it's a wild, wild west out there. You don't, you know, and then like we turn on our iPads or computers and it's like magic. Like, you know, I remember carrying boxes of cards to the computer center to get data out. Now my students laugh at me because I touch a button and the statistics pop out. I jump around like a kid on Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it's a miracle age. So I think kids grow up thinking, well, I just buy a pill, will fix everything. So I think as parents, we need to kind of talk about kind of responsible use. And we know Americans are over-medicated in general. And I think that's a discussion we may want to talk. And again, part of it's education. We have a grant right now with the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency to look at some national data, and with Lance Armstrong and the things now, they're very concerned. It ties into some of the other things we talked about ethics education. So why is there a culture that Lance Armstrong cheats for 10 years? Why is that acceptable? And we think a lot of it goes back to some of the things in youth sports where you do anything to win. No, you don't. You strive to win and you do anything within the rules. But how do we help kids learn what moral standards are and make good moral judgments? And, you know, if we look historically, we've always said sport builds character. And I believe that, or I wouldn't be here under the right conditions. But if that's the case, was Enron caused by Little League? You know, because about 10 years before the Enron and some of the scandal on Wall Street, we had these controversies in Little League about lying about ages. Mm-hmm. So if kids learn good values from sport, if they learn to cut corners, if they learn to cheat, if they learn it's okay to take anything to get ahead, then why wouldn't 10 years later we be dealing with that problem? So I think early intervention, education.
But most parents, I mean, I've watched my friends, I'll say, who are not very good consumers of the things that are there because they want to feel healthier. There's a sense that all these things are really good for you. And if they're being sold, they must be good for you because somebody would have stopped them from being sold. But it does develop some tendencies that become more difficult, particularly if you put, let's say, a young man, a young woman in a position where they want to play more, their parents want them to play more, the coach wants them to play more, and you don't want to be called wimpy or, or anything because you're not tough enough to do that. So there is, I think, developing for lots of reasons, culturally or around sport, not a very good conversation about what this means. Now, if I'm the great swimmer, let's say, and I'm picked out at 12 to be, because right now we were picking out kids really early to be great, okay, this elite athlete, whether you're a gymnast or you're a swimmer or you're a runner or in some cases you're a hockey player because of I get to play at the highest level in my traveling team and leave my friends behind. But those are really unregulated in terms of or don't have information that, you know, that others who are part of this younger Olympic movement might have. So how do we get people to think and talk about this and understand what they're reading and getting?
Well, I think there's the internet is, on one hand, this great thing that educates us all. On the other hand, it's this, you know, if I'm a predator, it's the best thing ever. If I'm a dirty, rotten scoundrel. So, you know, somebody once said at the library, it might have been you actually, but at the library, we always had someone approving what books come in. Now nobody approves anything. So I say go to trusted sources.
Well, it's not approving, it's reviewing.
Yeah, reviewing. And,
right,
and
so you get a peer review. Of when you publish a book, I publish a book, you publish a book, we go through a whole bunch of editors. People are doing content checks on our work in order for me to publish a book, in order for you to publish a book. It's true in referee journals, Nature, you can't get an article in without 10 other people looking at it and deciding if your facts are credible. Mm-hmm. On the internet, there's no such, it's not really controlling, there's just no such peer review process that gives a quality assurance.
But if it's in writing, it's true.
Yeah.
I read it on the internet.
But I think one thing that we're trying to get people to do, like if you go to the American College of Sports Medicine, look at their website, it's pretty solid, and you're going to get that. If you go to the U.S. Tennis Association, I do a lot of work with them. They have a superior sports science site, and there's experts on there. So I think trying to go to sites that are pretty credible, like the U.S. Tennis Association, American College of Sports Medicine, I think we need, as a university, that's a huge role for us, letting people know, like, this is a pretty good protected brand, vetted website that you could go to.
So if I wanted to know what those are as a parent, where would I find them? On your website, on our website? How could I get that information?
Probably contact us would be one, and we could get back to it.
Us meeting
the Institute for the Study of Youth Sports at Michigan State.
Okay, so that's a resource for
people. That's a resource. I think going to the U.S. Olympic Committee website, organizations that are stable, been around a long time, any of your sport governing bodies like U.S. Tennis, USA Wrestling, will direct you to the Olympic Committee, which has a variety of resources that they usually on those sites don't put it up if they're vetted. If it's some site you're not sure about, you've never heard the name, doesn't mean it's bad, but I just would be more guarded than sort of like a Michigan State or a U.S. Olympic Committee where we think the information is more vetted.
Well, I think, as I said off the top, I'm bubbling with more questions now than when I even started. And we've talked about the youth. We talked about transition into the business world. And there's so much in the middle, both from my NCAA role as well as Michigan State, that I'd like to sit down and share with you either in front or behind a microphone. Okay. But we really enjoyed having you here today. You've already got a couple emails from me, and you're going to get a couple more soon. I'd just like to engage more because I think it's a fascinating connection and makes such a difference in our lives, and we appreciate what you do.
Well, and Dan, I want to thank you. I mean, I think it's important to note that this has been work that Michigan State has been doing for a very long time, that it's not simply because there's a hot issue now about concussions or one of these other more visible things because the President of the United States has decided to raise the issue. This work has been very persistent. It's something we're doing not only in the laboratory, but with sports groups and with people around the state. And you are a great, your unit is a great resource. So thank you for taking on this important work on behalf of the children of not only Michigan, but the world.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
That was Dan Gould, director of MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports, talking with Spartans athletic director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University president Luana K. Simon. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.